Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Veronica Sands and I'll be reading Playboy for Winter 2020 here on Sight into Sound Radio. So the first article I'm going to read to you is our Playmate of the Month for March 2020, Marigold Rush, with photography by Ali Mitten. The journey from Laos to the United States is not so far with March Playmate and lifelong explorer Anita Pathmavavong as your guide. Marigolds fill the pool, and I breathe in the verdant aroma as the florists trim their stems. In front of the lens, I can move, flow, and express myself completely. All around me, the energy is strong. The confidence I feel today is the result of an ever-evolving journey of exploration and self-acceptance. Coming from a multicultural background, I was 6 years old when my family moved from Laos to the Virginia suburbs. I've always had a kaleidoscopic view of beauty standards, societal expectations, and my own identity. My dad first relocated to Northern Virginia during the Vietnam War, and my mother went to an all-girls Catholic school in Thailand before she moved to Washington, D.C. at 17. I was raised with pretty traditional views surrounding femininity and sexuality. The American school system wasn't much help, and my relationship to my body was mostly informed by what I saw on television. It took years of curiosity and community building to get to a place where I felt grounded and comfortable in my own skin. Even now, at the age of 23, I'm still learning new things. After high school, I went to New York and immediately fell in love with the rhythm and intensity of the city. But when I started modeling, I had to compete in an industry that prioritized skinny bodies and European features. I've struggled against those biases for most of my career. It's definitely shifted, but I don't want companies to be inclusive merely because it's a trend. I want people to lean into these conversations even though they can be uncomfortable. That's how perspectives change. People should be able to open up magazines and see models of all shapes, sizes, and races. They should be able to see images of women they can relate to. I believe that empathy is the first step toward equality. We simply cannot let discrimination be indulged and privilege weaponized to divide people. We need to take time to listen and educate instead of coming from a place of pain and anger. That's why one of my dreams is to invest in land in Laos. My father and I have a plan to open an orphanage and recruit teachers because the educational system stops around middle school. And I want to start a nonprofit that will raise money to remove the leftover landmines still planted along the border of Laos and Vietnam. I am a model with curves, a woman with Southeast Asian, Native American, and European roots. I'm just proud to be me. Okay, so beautiful Anita is absolutely gorgeous. She's got exotic good looks. She's got olive skin, long dark hair all the way down to her waist. I would say it's dark brown, short blunt bangs that hit the middle of her forehead, thick perfectly arched eyebrows, almond-shaped dark brown eyes, a nice soft round face, beautiful straight nose, beautiful plump lips, and she's got very long legs. She's very pretty, very exotic looking. And in this one picture, she is wearing a gold goddess beautiful dress. It's absolutely stunning. You can see the sun is coming down on her. She's got her eyes closed. Her right arm is on the top of her head. She's got her chin lifted up towards the sun. You can see a glossy kind of copper look on her eyeshadow, and the dress is absolutely stunning. It's just soft, flowing, and behind her is a big jug. It's a very exotic location that she's in. And then the next picture, she's on her back in a beautiful pool, and she's just floating on her back with marigolds all around her. And in our next beautiful picture, it looks like she's in some kind of villa because you can see these white walls, stucco walls, and she's in the garden, I believe. You see cactuses, and she's jumping from rock to rock. So there's a little pool in the middle, this little pool, and there's marigolds all in the pool, and she's still has this beautiful gold silk dress on, and she's just jumping from rock to rock. And like I said, she has all this exotic jewelry. She's got bangles around each wrist, like halfway up her forearm, gold bangles, beautiful jeweled sandals. And she's wearing a belly chain, a necklace, all gold. She has a tiny little piercing, a little ring in her nostril. And she has very strong features, very beautiful, nice curves, long legs, very confident pose. A beautiful picture of her again swimming on her back, doing a backstroke. Next picture, she's sitting outside by the pool, her long wet hair. She's just kind of drying off. She has her chin kind of tilted to her left knee. She's just kind of, just in a nice little curved pose, and she's looking straight at the camera. She doesn't have much makeup on, although she just has just a little bit of some copper colored eyeshadow, and it just brings out her natural beautiful looks. In the next picture, she's wearing a gold headband, so it's very pretty. She's just absolutely stunning to look at. And now we have her data sheet. So her birthplace is Nong Khai, Thailand, and her current city is New York City, New York. On parent traps. My parents first separated when we moved to the States, and my mother raised me, my older sister, and my younger brother as a single mom. When I was in high school, my parents actually got back together. It was a real parent trap situation, sans twin swapping. And they've been together ever since. On destiny. I was working with my dear friend Patricia Meyervet, who showed me her May 1993 Playmate pictorial in Playboy, Germany. I decided then, I'm going to do Playboy. A few months later, I was talking to my friend Faux Porter, the April 2019 Playmate, and she asked me how I would feel about posing for Playboy. I told her, I love Playboy. It would be a dream. Next thing I know, I have an interview with a casting director, and 2 weeks later, I'm locked in. I honestly feel like I spoke it into existence. On staying afloat. I recently heard a bit of good advice. You can't fly like an eagle if you hang around with turkeys. On staying grounded. In New York, you're constantly absorbing different people's energies. It can become too intense if you don't remove yourself from it. I like meditating, dancing around my room, and going upstate to get out of the city. On guilty pleasures. Cheesy romantic movies. The Sex and the City movie, Pretty Woman, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, I love them all. Eat, Pray, Love is great. On springing forward. Spring is one of my favorite seasons because it's when things become new. Flowers bloom, the weather starts warming up, the transformative time when you can finally step out of your cocoon. Spread those wings. On pet peeves. People who litter. I usually give them a dirty look and pick up whatever they've thrown on the ground. It's somewhere between passive-aggressive and fully aggressive. On giving back. The issues I raise awareness for are protecting indigenous people and their land, preserving the Amazon, fighting for racial justice and women's rights, and helping the environment. I look up to strong women who advocate for these causes, including Chinapa Kambasanga, the founder and executive director of Legacies of War, an organization that seeks to address the problem of unexploded ordnance in my home country of Laos. Okay, so that is our March 2020 Playmate, Anita Pathmalagajong, and she's absolutely beautiful. We have photography by Ali Mitten. And next, we're going to move on to our Playboy Symposium. We have on Playmate, always a Playmate. Once a Playmate, always a Playmate. Photography by Nadia Lee Cohen, and this article here is by Jamila Lemieux. In 2020, the notion of sex positivity has found new enthusiasm among young women who believe true bodily autonomy means having the right to enjoy and participate in what was once written off as objectification. The present-day pinup is less concerned with how she appears before the male gaze than how she feels about herself. She no longer needs photographers and publications. She can direct her own shoots and post them on Instagram. Her modeling may be a rewarding hobby or means of amassing an empire. This raises a question. What does this mean for Playboy and its most famous Franchise. Once a playmate, always a playmate goes the motto of the nearly 800 women who have held the title. But what is a playmate anyway? Who is she? And who has she been all along? Not to be confused with Playboy bunnies or other women who've posed for the magazine, the honorific is short for Playmate of the Month, the designation bestowed on those who appear in the magazine's preeminent pictorial. It debuted in Playboy's first issue as Sweetheart of the Month in 1953 and featured a 23-year-old Marilyn Monroe on red velvet, her perkiness jutting out and her hips twisted. Then came the data sheet, which in the past listed Playmate's turn-ons, turn-offs, and measurements. The last, I suppose, in case fans wanted to make them a fancy dress. Depending on the eye of the beholder, these women are either unwitting agents of patriarchy, selling their bodies for fame and fortune and the adoration of the men typically necessary for securing those things, or liberated trailblazers in some ways some members of their gender could never imagine. Describing their origin, this magazine's founder said, "The innovation of our Playmate pictorials was to humanize the pinup concept." Well, why should pinups require humanizing in the first place? Is it because men, the intended market for these images, don't typically see hot, naked chicks as anything but a sum of measurements? Or was it a matter of removing women from pinup settings to make the fantasy more real? Playmate pictorials have exhibited everything from camp to romance to self-awareness, sometimes all together. The shoots found women romping in mansions or on beaches or draped on top of fancy cars. Playmates always seemed to be winking at the camera, literally and figuratively, and delighting in their nakedness. Can you really take issue with pretty girls of happy girls, pictures of happy girls having fun? Is it really objectification? If the object in question appears so deeply satisfied, even objectification must be viewed, well, objectively. Yes, many men have enjoyed reducing us women to sexual fantasies or subjecting us to brief lusty glares, but those men can't parlay fantasies and glares into fame and fortune, can they? Throughout history, playmates have also come to represent a type of beauty. Personally, I took little interest in the superstar models of the 1990s during my childhood. Their bodies were not the ones I thought of while staring at my pudgy 13-year-old body in the mirror before vomiting whatever I'd last eaten, and they were not top of mind when I started working out a decade later. I did love Anna Nicole Smith, though, and have always found the relative autonomy playmates enjoy to be enviable. Imagine having not just a physique so universally accepted you could bear it on the pages of this magazine, but the courage to do so, and be paid to do so. There's something fascinating about the gamble of a woman who could have accessed the relative protection and spoils of beauty elsewhere. It's a gamble that might have catapulted her into her dreams or cost her everything, just for daring to be that kind of sexual. Alas, sexy is more complicated than beautiful and historically causes division among feminists. Some still consider sex work, stripping, and pinup modeling to be irredeemable and misogynistic, positing that the male gaze is inextricable from these institutions even if they are women-owned. Others feel the ability for us to exist in those spaces is essential, or at the very least, a necessary option. To be allowed a space to identify as beautiful without rebuttal from your community and popular culture is a civil right granted to only a small percentage of people in this country. So when it comes to beauty standards, we must do more to expand than destroy. Instead of dismissing the girl next door as antiquated, the most progressive of us must reshape norms to include all complexions, all ages, all sexual identities, and all body types. That's why this shoot is so important. We see these playmates under two scopes, as a response to the progressiveness that demands evolution, but also as godmothers to the autonomous and diverse pinups of today. One could make the case that without women like Victoria Valentino, September 1963 playmate, Candace Collins Jordan, December 1979 playmate, Renee Tennyson, November 1989 Playmate and first African-American Playmate of the Year in 1990, Brandi Roderick, April 2000 Playmate and 2001 Playmate of the Year, and Raquel Pomplin, April 2012 Playmate and the first Mexican-American Playmate of the Year in 2013. We might not have autonomous bodies, whether tattooed, stretch-marked, pierced, and or postpartum, filling Instagram feeds. These playmates remind us that all bodies are worthy of public reverence, but Valentino, at the age of 77, makes the point most compellingly. Valentino's presence is powerful because in 2014, she came forward after more than 40 years of silence to allege sexual abuse against Bill Cosby. Why did they wait so long is a constant challenge to the 60-plus Cosby accusers. Women who've put their sexuality on display struggle to be recognized as legitimate victims of sexual violence. But Valentino expresses gratitude for having been given this platform, so I might use for my voice for social good. She's different, a different sort of beautiful, perhaps more alluring, than the average pert 20-something could hope to be. Once a playmate, always a playmate. The motto could variously refer to these models' sisterhood or their fans' adoration, which continues long after newsstand dates. Inadvertently, it also brings to mind how a woman's past is always considered, regardless of her present. Many playmates have achieved mainstream success all the same. Valentino is a woman's right activist. Jordan is a columnist. Tennyson owns two clothing stores. Roderick is a realtor. And Pomplin is a comedian. I feel sexier in my 40s than I did in my 20s, Roderick says. And I worry about the young women who think they can't be powerful if nudity is involved. For Pomplin, that's why this shoot represents a rebellion in the face of criticism and judgment. Adds Jordan, I want to show women that beauty and sexuality have no limits. Women publicly taking pleasure in their bodies and sexuality is still a radical act, and it becomes more radical as we age. By returning to the pages of Playboy, these women do more than prove they've still got it. Perhaps here is where they truly humanize, the pinup reminding the world that our beauty doesn't fade with the years. It simply changes shape. Our sexuality does not deplete with age. It evolves. We made it to a time when a richer experience of womanhood has found its place in a world once built on youth and the perceived absence of physical flaws. There may not be a consensus over what that means, but it certainly feels like progress. Okay, so this is a wonderful pictorial of all these beautiful past playmates. And let's see. So we have, and they're all different ages, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. So first picture, we have them all. They're all, it's kind of a retro picture. So pictures, photo shoot. We have, let's see, Victoria Valentino. She's in her 70s and she's got blonde hair and it's curled, parted in the middle, kind of a 60s vibe with a little bubble flip on the end. She's drinking a martini. She's sitting out by the pool wearing a silk house coat with a fur trim collar. And she's got a beautiful smile across her face, long sharp nails. And then we have, I believe this would be Candace Collins. And she's sitting next to her, her beautiful gray hair, slicked back, blondish gray hair, slicked back, long dangling earrings, also holding a martini. They're sitting out by the pool and they've got an old school telephone, cordless phone, the big blocky one. And then they've got on the table, they also have, let's see, some sunblock, some suntan. And they're just drinking their martinis. And then we see two of the other models in their bathing suits in the pool behind them. The next picture is inside the house, and this is, like I said, it's got a nice retro kind of look going about. So we've got the stone wall, wood paneled walls. They're in a kitchen. All of them are in these kind of fancy house coats, long blonde hair, brown hair, wearing a nightie, a long pretty satiny muumuu, and one's holding a punch bowl, one of the women's holding a punch bowl, and they're all just engaged in conversation, beautiful smiles across their face, gorgeous bodies, and holding balloons. So they're having a nice little house party, like a slumber party house party. And then another picture there, one of them is holding a deck of cards. They're playing cards. They have all the cards spread out in front of them. Then you can, another picture, looks like it's Raquel Pomplin. She's got her hair pulled up. She's smiling at the camera. And she's dancing. The next picture is absolutely beautiful. We've got Victoria Valentino in the middle. She's wearing this light robin egg blue coat, house coat, with green lapels, light green lapels, a gold chain belt, and her arms are spread out like she's ready to embrace everybody. Her chin is tilted up. She's got soft lines around her face, still has a beautiful figure, black eyeliner around her eyes. And then we've got the other four models just all around her. And they all have the kind of 60s hair with the bubble flip going, where it's kind of been teased at the crown of the hair, curled slightly on the very bottom, and with all the kind of bluish eyeshadow, black cattail eyeliner going on, soft pink lips, beautiful shades of every color skin, and they're all just off looking into the future. It's a very beautiful picture. So that is once a playmate, always a playmate. And now we're going to move on to our heritage section. First article is Diamond Days. To celebrate the 60th anniversary of the iconic Playboy Bunny, we asked more than a dozen bunnies and one rabbit to take a hop with us down memory lane. On February 29th, 1960, the first Playboy Club opened its doors and into pop culture bounded the bunny. With her satin ears, sheer stockings, bone corset, and white tail, the cuffs and the collars came later. She has resided in our collective imagination ever since. Like the indelible Playboy rabbit head, the bunny symbolizes the ideal of sophisticated pleasure. But unlike the inanimate logo, the bunnies had the hard work of actually bringing that ideal to life. It was a good job, if you could get it. Hundreds of bunny hopefuls typically applied at each new club, some company-owned and others franchise-operated. Bunnies could be found working in 25 states and 7 countries, and after Playboy's private DC-9 airplane took off in the early 1970s in the sky as well. From Jamaica to New Jersey, London to Lansing and Omaha to Osaka, the Playboy hotels, casinos, and resorts offered endless amenities and activities. Horseback riding, scuba diving, skeet shooting, skiing, roulette. The bushy-tailed bunny was the ever-present standard bearer, and still is. Visit our Playboy Club in London. Bunny training was rigorous and standards were high. The so-called bunny mothers were managers who enforced rules laid out in the intimidatingly thick bunny manual. But for the bunnies, tips and other perks included tuition assistance and appearance fees made the difficult job worthwhile. In the early 1980s, for example, bunnies hired to appear at events approved by Playboy earned $17.50 an hour, more than 5 times the minimum wage. The clubs were showplaces for comedians, jazz musicians, and other performers, but it was the bunnies, with their practice to perfection perch, stance, and dip, who were the steady draw. For a short while in the mid-1980s, rabbits, male servers who were bunny counterparts, had their time in the New York hutch. More than 1,500 men applied for 25 positions. It would be a mistake to look at the bunny and see only a waitress. She was so much more. When the bunny first arrived on the scene 60 years ago, the world was still adjusting to the idea of women who unapologetically owned their attractiveness or leveraged it as a part of their job. Criticism came from various corners, including undercover bunny Gloria Steinem's two-part 1963 story in Show magazine. But where some saw sexism, most bunnies saw opportunity. As one told the New York Times in 1976, "We're exploiting men. They're not exploiting us. After all, those poor slobs just want to come in here and see us." Many former bunnies credit their time working at the clubs as formative to the women they became. "I really owe my PhD, my first one, to Hugh Hefner and Playboy," says Elizabeth Clark, a psychologist and psychoanalyst who was known in the original New York club as Bunny Dana. Playboy paid for 2 college courses every semester, My graduate level classes at New York University were in the daytime and I could still work at night. It was perfect. Then, as now, it took guts and grit to be a bunny. On the occasion of the bunny's diamond anniversary, we reached out to 17 former bunnies and one rabbit. Among their ranks, a doctor, two rock singers, a film editor, an attorney, and a social worker, and asked them about their time wearing the ears, read on for their memories, building character and bank accounts. Offering excellent pay, flexible hours, and tuition aid, working as a bunny was often seen as the best gig in town. Gloria Hendry, New York Club, 1965 to 1972. Actor, singer, model, legal secretary. I became a bunny because of the money. Sometimes I made up to $2,000 a week. I was dabbling in acting, and I could never have afforded classes if I hadn't been a bunny. Thanks to the hours, I was able to go out on auditions, and I got my first Screen Actors Guild movie role in For Love of Ivy with Sidney Poitier and Abby Lincoln. Sabrina Scharf Schiller, New York and Bahamas Club, 1962 to 1963. Attorney. I thought if I worked very hard and saved diligently, it would give me the serious start I needed for my education. And that's exactly what happened. I worked the first 60 days for the club without a day off, in 3-inch heels, often doing double shifts. With tips, I was taking home the unheard of amount of $100 per day. Mid-level career men weren't earning that much, let alone young women. Marilyn Cole, London Club, 1971-1974. Journalist, 1973 Playmate of the Year. Playboy made us financially independent, a rare thing for 21-year-old girls. We could travel, buy our own cocktails and the latest fashions, even have mortgages and build our own lives. That was powerful. Katherine Lee Scott, New York Club, 1963 to 1966. Actor, author, were partial to her 1998 book, The Bunny Years. I was a scholarship student at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, working at Bloomingdale's part-time when I saw the ad. Girls, step into the spotlight. Become a Playboy bunny. It sounded like fun, glamour, good pay, and perfect hours for my class schedule. Lauren Hutton and I met in the long line to audition, and Keith Hefner hired both of us. Debbie Harry, New York Club, 1968, lead singer and songwriter for Blondie. It's not a job or career choice for everyone. However, it was a good education for me, and the Playboy clubs always had a high regard for the women who worked there. Being a bunny was the right decision for me, as I have always liked the naughty and nice sides of a story. At the Vanguard. As the sexual revolution got underway in the 1960s, influenced in no small part by Playboy, other social changes were transforming the cultural landscape. Sabrina Scharf Schiller. Women's lives were changing drastically. The advent of the pill brought about more control over our bodies and our choices. There was a total shift in social mores, and bunnies were on the front lines of that change. We were the innocent representation of the concept that sex is fun. Only the appearance was naughty. Angeline Chester, Chicago Club, 1972 to 1984. Journalist, 1974 International Bunny of the Year. The very first woman who won International Bunny of the Year, Gina Byrams, was a woman of color. You have to remember the times. Race relations were strained. In 1974, I won my local bunny competition, and some people said, just go to LA and have a good time. They're not going to pick a woman of color after another woman of color. I didn't believe that. I thought I had just as good a chance as anybody, and I went on to win. Jennifer Jackson, Chicago Club, 1964. Social worker, March 1965 Playmate. The 1960s were an amazing period, you know? The Black Movement, Vietnam, the hippies, the Beatles, Motown. There hasn't been a more exciting time since. Francesca Emerson, New York and Los Angeles Clubs, 1963 to 1968, film editor. The Playboy Club was known for hiring minorities even in the early 1960s when some places were still segregated. I was a Black unmarried mother living in New York City, and Playboy gave me confidence, independence, financial security, adventure, and opportunities that would have never come to me had I still been working the counters at Bloomingdale's or serving coffee and donuts in some uptown takeout joint. You're listening to Playboy on Side Into Sound Radio. You can listen to Side Into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, Channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as Amazon Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our archives page at sideintosound.org. We're Side Into Sound Radio since 1967. Gloria Hendry. The club was wonderful. If somebody grabbed my tail or said something derogatory to me, like, "I don't want that black bunny waiting on me," the room director would walk over and say, "May I have your Playboy key, please? Now get out and never come back." What can I say? They protected us. They took care of us. And that's my experience. Getting the gig. Every bunny or rabbit forged their own path to Playboy Club. Gwen Wong Wayne, Los Angeles Cub and Big Bunny Airplane, 1965 to 1975. Interior designer, April 1967 playmate. My aunt was a bunny in Miami and New York, and she had some great stories to tell. I think she was the catalyst for my career with Playboy. I showed some pictures to Keith Hefner, and he immediately asked if I could work at the Miami Club. I couldn't leave my two children, but Keith promised that when the LA Club opened, I would be one of the first to get a bunny suit. When the club was interviewing hundreds of girls, I thought Keith had probably forgotten about me. He had not. He was a man of his word, and I was in. Yay! Later, I became a jet bunny on Playboy's plane. Connie Mason Caston, Miami and Chicago Clubs, 1961 to 1962. Actor, in June 1963, playmate. It was a much coveted job, just like being chosen to be in the Miss America pageant. Tony Roma had suggested to my dad that I apply since the bunnies made such good tips. During my bunny hopping years, I gained tremendous self-confidence and was able to support my two little ones as a single mother. Jeff Rector, New York Empire Club, 1985 to 1986, actor, writer. When word got around that Playboy was looking for waiters, every Chippendale thought he would get the job. But Playboy didn't want a bunch of beefcakes who just strolled around looking pretty. You had to do your job and do it well. It's the only job I've ever had where I couldn't wait to go to work. Dale Bosio, Boston Club, 1973 to 1976. Musician, lead singer for Missing Persons. I was 18 years old when I became a Playboy bunny in Boston. Out of 250 girls, they hired four, and I was one of them. Training lasted weeks. I learned how to use my beauty in a kind, precious manner. I became the best bunny I could possibly be. Barracudas and Tough Mothers. The bunny gig came with some exacting standards, sometimes too exacting, and demanding tasks. Angela and Chester. It was not a hairnet type of job. We had weeks of grueling training. You had to learn how to carry a tray with two heavy telephone books and how to carry the tray at your waist. You had to be strong to high carry, to walk in those heels, to serve. And you had to be fast. Once I got my tray, it was like a badge of honor. You got your tray, your flashlight, and your name tag. It was like a flight attendant getting her wings. Pat Lacey, Los Angeles and Jamaica Clubs and Big Bunny, 1965-1978, Playboy Promotion Specialist Writer. We did a weigh-in every month. You had to stay within 5 pounds of your original weight. Being a bunny was a workout. You developed strong arms from all the lifting and bunny dipping. The night manager called us experienced bunnies, barracudas, because you had to be tough to make it. When I was a bunny mother and we needed 5 girls, we'd get 10 to start. Not all of them would make it. Girls would get demerits for lateness, for shoes that weren't polished, but they were smart and knew how to get by my inspections. Sabrina Scharf Schiller. I did not like the weekly weigh-in to ensure a trim bunny figure was kept under control. Those costumes were tight and we knew we'd had one dessert too many. In the Warren. Myriad positions were available at the clubs. Door bunnies, floor bunnies, pool bunnies, cabaret bunnies, and more. Sharon Long, Kansas City and Jamaica Clubs, 1966 to 1968, businesswoman. I took over the pool table shortly after starting. It was perfect for me. I loved it, and it taught me a lot about being an entrepreneur, though I wasn't aware of it at the time. I learned how to take chances, how to trust my judgment, and most importantly, how to step out of the mold that had been created for women at that time. Joyce Nazari, Chicago, Miami, and New Orleans clubs, 1960. Playboy Mansion executive assistant, December 1958 playmate. I worked at the original Chicago club during the first week it opened as a door bunny, checking key numbers. I wore the bunny costume with no collars or no cuffs because they hadn't been added to the uniform yet. The lines to get in were so long that the numbers were almost never fully closed. The doors were never almost fully closed. I remember getting snow on my costume. Gloria Hendry. I wound up starting as a cigarette bunny, saying, "Cigars, cigarettes, Tipperillos, Playboy lighters, $1.05. I'll never forget those lines. And men used to come by and give me $100 or $50 tips. Pat Lacey. After 6 years of training in Indiana in an enormous hangar and in Florida for water evacuation training and in Wisconsin at the Lake Geneva Club, where the Playboy chef taught us how to prepare gourmet meals, I became a jet bunny. Normally, a flight would have just one pre-flight FAA inspector. But on the Big Bunny, there were always multiple inspectors. They wanted to see Hef's plane and the jet bunnies. Carol Cleveland, London Club, 1966. Comedian, writer, and Monty Python cast member. I started off in the cabaret room. Once I took people's orders and the show started, I could watch the cabaret. Dave Allen was a well-known comedian here in England, and he was a star when I first started. I was a great fan and happy as could be watching him perform every night. Life lessons from the dressing room. Co-workers became friends who became family within the special society of bunnydom. Marilyn Cole. The bunny room was the most liberating place. There was swearing, nudity, camaraderie, and pluralism. I learned about politics, social justice, and religious diversity. A bunny roommate had been born in Aden as a Zoroastrian, and she called it the oldest religion in the world. She would burn incense and pray every night, even wear a religious garment around her waist underneath her bunny costume. Carolyn Lee Scott. I was a farm kid from the Midwest, mixing with 110 other women in every size and shape from every religious, ethnic, cultural, economic, and racial background from all over the world. The bunny dressing room, circa 1963, was more diverse than a college campus even 20 years later. A single mother from a Harlem project donned the same jewel-colored costume as an aerist, an East German refugee who escaped the Berlin Wall, the daughter of a Chinese diplomat, a gap-toothed tomboy who became a supermodel. I interviewed them all for the bunny years. Candace Collins Jordan, St. Louis and Chicago Clubs, 1973 to 1977, columnist and December 1979 playmate. The bunnies were the sisters I never had. It was a unique sorority and a joy for me. Francesca Emerson. We bonded like glue. Playboy was like a gigantic family of different people of different backgrounds and different cultures, all working hard to improve themselves. When we weren't working, we'd meet at each other's houses and have lunches and dinners together, participate in each other's kids' birthday parties, even take vacations together. Half a century later, I still have close friendships from the New York and L.A. clubs. Misconceptions. Donning the ears could come with some baggage. Marilyn Cole. I'm shocked that I still sometimes have to defend myself for having been a bunny and a playmate. It was a woman who interviewed me. It was a woman who trained me. It was a woman who did PR at the club. Playboy magazine's photo editor was a woman. The first woman gaming inspector in the UK casino industry had been a Playboy croupier bunny. I wish people knew that. Who would have thought that we would have such an impact on social history? The bunnies were pioneers. We stood for freedom. Candace Collins Jordan. I wish people understood what a wonderful opportunity this was for women like me instead of thinking we were exploited. It was our choice to be bunnies. We made great money and great friends and had wonderful opportunities that are now lasting memories. It was priceless and a life-changing experience for me and made me who I am today. Jennifer Jackson. In the 1960s and 1970s, no one thought black people were pretty. And then people saw me as a beautiful black woman and the black is beautiful in all different shades. That was one of the things we promoted. Catherine Lee Scott. Former bunnies including entrepreneurs, lawyers, judges, CEOs, professors, architects, restaurateurs, scientists, and a few actors and writers, none of us turning in our satin ears to collect Social Security. Angela and Chester. Hefner sent a memo to corporate explaining that if it were not for the women, the playmates, and the bunnies in particular, that the company would not exist. So they are to be respected and not harassed. He was ahead of his time when it came to policies like that. Good times, great memories. From celebrity customers to softball stardom, the bunnies and rabbits led unforgettable lives. Pat Lacey. In Jamaica, they had goat racing on the beach for guests to watch. Guys would climb the trees and grab fresh coconuts right off the palms. During the day, before 6 p.m., we wore two-piece bikini, ears, and tail, and with flip-flops. And in the evenings, the standard bunny costume. I overstayed my visa and got booted from the country. Elizabeth Clark. New York and Montreal clubs, 1965 to 1975. Psychologist and psychoanalyst. I was working the Playmate bar one night, and this guy was at my station all by himself, wearing a hat and raincoat. I took his order, scotch and water or something, and I served it to him. The bartender said, "Do you know who that guy you're waiting on is?" I said, "No, why?" And he says, "That's Paul Newman." I said, "Who's Paul Newman?" Jeff Rector. Wherever we went, people were like, "Oh my God, it's the bunnies and rabbits from the Playboy Club." We would get into any club anytime. We could get reservations at any restaurant. We were treated like celebrities. Francesca Emerson. Playing on the bunny softball team is one of my favorite memories. It started as a charity event in the Chicago club and was so successful it spread throughout the clubs. The New York club's team was so competitive. Every Thursday at noon, the Dream Team, as we were known, played in Central Park. We wore black tights and orange sweaters with the bunny logo on the front. The Tail End. A parting thought from a beloved bunny. Dale Bosio. I'm the proudest bunny. Everything I learned as a Playboy bunny brought me to today. I'm 64 years old. I go on stage every month, maybe four times a month. I learned to be courageous and to be a proud woman and to know how beautiful I am. I learned to love myself. And that's where I'm coming from. That's how I write all my music. That's how I live my life. And that's how I've raised my sons. Reporting by Tori Lynn Adams, Kat Auer, Andy Eisen, and Michelle Slegel. And we have some great pictures of our bunnies. One of these first pictures we have is of Sandy Lawrence at the New York Club, circa 1963. She's a beautiful African-American woman, short hair, beautiful brown eyes. She has red satin bunny ears, the collar, the bow tie, the red corset, and she's kind of just looking over her right shoulders. Very, very pretty. And then we have a picture at Playboy's Lake Geneva Resort. Guests could partake in various seasonal activities, from skiing to swimming to horseback riding with friendly assistance from bunnies, Playmate and bunny Gwen Wong Wayne. And let's see. It's a very cute picture. So we have Gwen on horseback, and she's got this beautiful... She's on horseback, sitting on the saddle, and she's wearing this beautiful purple corset, pink psychedelic corset, black tights, the white collar, black bow tie, psychedelic ears, her hair is in pigtails, and then we've got a bunny, they're in the meadow, and then we've got another bunny, she's got this gorgeous smile on her face, she's wearing a red corset leotard with white designs on it, the black tights, bunny tail, matching ears, and then we have another bunny in the background. She's also on horseback, and she's wearing green satin ears, green corset, and they look like they're having a wonderful time. And let's see. We have a couple more pictures. We have a picture of Cynthia Maddox, and she's modeling an early collarless, cuffless version of the bunny suit, architectural model of the Chicago Club in the background. So she's got blonde hair, she's got her hands on her hips, she's looking over her left shoulder, it's a backside view, and she's wearing a leotard. I'm not sure. It's a black and white photo, but she's got seamed stockings on, satiny heels. It looks like a white suit, white bunny tail, little frou-frou furry around the top half of the bunny costume. And then the next picture we have is of Scotty Scott of the New Orleans Club, works as a pool bunny. And Scotty Scott, she's blonde hair all the way down to her hips, wearing a black bunny suit. She's got the pool stick in her hand. She's playing pool. The next picture we have is each bunny's garment is custom fit to her needs by an experienced seamstress. So we have a seamstress. You can see they're in a dressing room, and she's on her knees. She's pinning up the bunny girl costume. And let's see, I think we have a couple more pictures from this article. We have jet bunnies take time off from their flight attendant duties on the Big Bunny to enjoy the sights in Venice, Italy in 1970. So it's a wonderful picture. We've got five bunnies, and you could see that it's 1970. They're wearing black suits that hit mid-thigh, long sleeve, long white scarves with a black rabbit on the little black logo rabbit, bunny rabbit, on the scarf. Their hair is all parted in the middle, very long, black stockings, black go-go boots up to the knee. They're all walking in stride all together. And then we have a picture of the front desk bunnies at the Detroit Club, and they update the welcome board. So we've got the welcome board, and they're putting at the Playboy Club tonight, and you've got all the girls' names and who's going to be on the club, and we've got two bunnies. One's wearing a yellow gold satin bunny suit, and the other one is wearing a pink satin suit. And then we have, let's see, two more pictures. We have a Budapest-born Marika Lucas at the Chicago Club, and she's very pretty, very cute. Blonde hair, cute big blue eyes, long lashes, a very beautiful sapphire blue bunny suit. And she's looking straight at the camera, kind of a serious look about her face, but very, very pretty. And we have announcing the musical entertainment at the Detroit Club, which opened in December 1963. So we have a beautiful bunny wearing a pink suit. And you see a jazz band right behind her. Men and women are in the club as she's about to announce who's on stage. And then the last picture we have is the first Playboy Club that opened in Chicago in 1960, introducing the world to the boldness of the bunny. So in this picture of the Playboy Club in Chicago, it's very modern look outside. You've got you see a car out front, pulled out in front of the curb, and the driver is actually wearing a jumpsuit with the Playboy logo on the back, rabbit on the back, and then you see some young gentlemen and a woman at the front of the club, under the awning. You can see them walking in. There's an elevator there to greet them, a doorman. And you've got the logo rabbits on the outside. So that is our heritage section, and that is titled Diamond Days. And our next story we're going to read is our strong suit. Recognize the world over, the bunny costume may be the most famous uniform ever created. Like many aspects of the Playboy history, the bunny suit owes much of its success to women and not just those who wear it. Founder Hugh Hefner originally wanted silky negligees at the club uniform, but was talked out of the impractical idea by Victor Lowndes, the promotions manager who was instrumental in the development of the club. Instead, Lowndes brought Hef a better idea, one Lowndes got from his girlfriend, actress Isla Torrens, whose name is spelled variably as Isla and Isle. As former bunny Catherine Lee Scott reports to the Bunny Years, Torrens suggested the costume be rabbit-based, a play on the magazine's emblem. Although Hefner had already considered and spurned the idea as too masculine, Torrens created a one-piece design with an attached tail and separate ears, according to Scott. Torrens' seamstress mother then assembled the prototype, which Lowndes showed to Hef. The costume wasn't quite daring enough for Hefner's vision, but with minor alterations, it formed the basis for the world-famous outfit that debuted at the Chicago Playboy Club in 1960. Quality of craftsmanship, in addition to the risk-taking fashion, surely also helped the costume's legacy. According to New York University Director of Costume Studies, Nancy Dale, the clubs commissioned talented women to custom-build the suits, including Zelda Wynn Valdez, who fabricated them for the New York Club that opened in December 1962. The bunny costume has withstood the test of time because of its simplicity, says Christy Beck, a Playboy senior manager and part of a group responsible for overseeing bunny selection and training. Small changes to the hair-raising getup have been made over the decades. The addition of the tuxedo collar and cuffs and a name tag rosette, a tweak to the high-cut leg, a slight redesign of the ears, more accommodating cup sizes, but the bunny remains as recognizable as ever. By the time the suit turned 20, various versions were in use alongside the solid color satin classics, suits with psychedelic patterns inspired by Emilio Pucci, a VIP suit in velvet, a lacy and short-lived cabaret version, and a fur-trimmed green or red Christmas look. And not all bunnies wore the famous suit. Season, location, and responsibility also dictated their attire, with non-corset-based outfits for ski bunnies, croupier bunnies, beach bunnies, and others. Today, Playboy Club servers wear suits that were updated in 2005 with accessories by designer Roberto Cavalli. In 2018, bunnies at the Coachella Music Fest wore a new green leaf pattern suit, but the original 1960s silhouette remains intact. Since its appearance 6 decades ago, the bunny suit has woven its way into the fabric of American culture, donned by everyone from Dolly Parton to Flip Wilson to Kate Moss. It was the first service uniform ever registered with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and a complete bunny costume can be found in the collection of the Smithsonian. Like other cultural mainstays, how it's seen often depends on who's looking at it, including the bunnies themselves. Bunnies like wearing it for different reasons, says Beck, who sometimes fits new bunnies into their suits. Some see it as powerful, some see it as playful and nostalgic, others see it as a badge of empowerment. We don't need to define it for them. Okay, so moving on to our next article, we have a few more minutes. Next article we're going to read is, I'm going to read to you, is Depth of Field, and this is also in our Heritage Spotlight. We train our lens on the magazine's founding photo editor for some long overdue exposure. This article here is by Cat Hour. Few jobs are as ready-made to inspire envy among lovers of women than that of Playboy photo director. Yet little has been written about the magazine's founding picture editor, Vincent T. Tajiri, who for 15 stratospheric years oversaw our photo department. During his tenure, Tajiri watched the print run top 7 million, thanks in large part to the teaming photographer and stringer ecosystem he developed. Praised as a gentleman and a deep thinker by his former employees, and also called a jerk by Hunter S. Thompson, more on that later, he remained an elusive figure among the many outsized personalities of Playboy's early years. So who was Vince Tajiri? Born in Southern California in 1919, Tajiri was a teenager when his older brother Larry went on to be a distinguished journalist, brought home a 35mm SLR camera from a reporting trip to Asia. Vince, who'd been priming himself to be a writer, fell in love with the medium. "I knew very little about photography then," he told Popular Photography in 1968. "But I shot promiscuously and uninhibitedly." At the same time he was developed his photography skills, he wrote prolifically for English language papers that served the Japanese American community. At the age of 18, he moved to San Francisco to work for one such daily, Nichibei Shimbun. The previous year, he had created Rigmarole, an intermittent Nichibei column that variously covered the Nisei, Americans who, like Tajiri, were born to immigrant parents from Japan. Sports stats, movies, and any other topic that caught Tajiri's attention. In February 1941, Tajiri was drafted into the Army. He was at Camp Bonneville in Washington State on December 7th of that year when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. The next day, the United States entered World War II, and less than 3 months later, the government ordered nearly 120,000 Japanese Americans living on the West Coast, the vast majority of them U.S.-born citizens, out of their homes and into incarceration camps. Among them were Tajiri's mother and younger siblings, who were sent to camp in Poston, Arizona, with only what they could carry. They lost everything, including the home they owned in San Diego. Tajiri was a sergeant in the 42nd Regimental Combat Team, the famed unit composed of Nisei soldiers that became the military's most decorated when he married his girlfriend, Rose Hayashi, in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, in August 1943, ahead of his expected deployment. Poor health ultimately kept Tajiri out of overseas duty. Three of his brothers volunteered to serve. One of who joined the Army out of Poston in 1943 was later awarded a Purple Heart. The inequity between the Tajiri service and the government's bigotry is almost too obvious to state, but Vince gave it eloquent expression in a September 1942 letter to the Fresno Bee. "Except for minor differences in pigment, we are just like you." Not only did the American Army have Japanese-American officers, he reminded readers, but another 16,000 are serving in the ranks. America's battle is our battle, and America's enemies are our enemies. After the war, Vince and Rose moved to Chicago, where they started a family. Vince took on freelance photo assignments and soon enough was working concurrently as editorial director of three photo-based titles, Guns Magazine, Art Photography, and Figurative Quarterly, the first two of which were titles of Publishers Development Corporation. While at PDC, Tajiri met Hugh Hefner, who worked in the circulation department by day and later in his kitchen on his nascent magazine by night. Both Art Photography and Figure Quarterly featured pinup and nude photography, and it's likely Tajiri's experience with such material helped Hefner see him as an attractive recruit. Okay, so we are going to stop there and continue Depth of Field next time. We've come to the end of our program. I've been reading Playboy for Winter 2020. You can hear Playboy Sunday and Thursday nights at 12 midnight. I'm Veronica Sands, and this has been a production of Sight & Sound Radio, Houston, Texas. Thank you.